He was born in the hills of Jamaica, raised in the heart of a concrete jungle, and rose to become the voice of the voiceless. Bob Marley didn't just make music. He sparked revolutions, calmed civil wars, and preached unity to a world divided. From the ghettos of Kingston to the battlefields of apartheid South Africa, his songs became weapons of peace, prayers of resistance, and anthems of freedom. This is not just the story of a man. It's the story of a global awakening, told through rhythm, rebellion, and redemption. The gospel, according to Bob Marley, still sings. And the echo? It never ends. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Bob Marley, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Trenchtown Sunrise. The story of Bob Marley does not begin in the flash of a stage light or the echo of a stadium chant. It begins beneath the blinding sun of a small hill in Nine Mile, a rural district tucked deep into the heart of St. Anne's Parish, Jamaica. It begins with red earth between bare toes, the sharp smell of sugarcane hanging in the air, and a boy named Robert Nesta Marley, born on February 6, 1945, who carried in his tiny chest a heart too large for the limits of the land around him. His mother, Sadella Malcolm, was just 18, barely a woman herself when she gave birth to her first child. She was dark-skinned, sharp-featured, strong in spirit. His father, Captain Norval Marley, was 50, a white British man with a fading military past and a quiet, ghost-like presence in the child's life. Their union was not one of love, but of consequence, an arrangement riddled with colonial tension and social taboo. Norval, in truth, was more specter than parent. He appeared rarely and spoke even less, leaving Sadella to raise their child alone amidst gossiping neighbors and the biting judgment of a society still soaked in post-slavery division. Bob, even as a child, was caught between two worlds, between the legacy of the oppressor and the reality of the oppressed. Half white in a black land, poor in a classist culture, he grew up with a haunting question lingering in the background. Where do I belong? In that question, seeds of something far greater were planted, something spiritual, musical, revolutionary. But before the answers, there was struggle. When Sadella moved them from Nine Mile to Kingston, it wasn't a step up. It was a descent into the urban jungle, the concrete labyrinth of Trenchtown. This was no paradise. It was a settlement constructed in the post-war era to house the displaced. Trenchtown was a patchwork of corrugated zinc fences, unpaved alleys, and cramped tenements. The air pulsed with reggae rhythms, but also reeked of sweat, smoke, and simmering poverty. Yet in that rawness, beneath all that dust and decay, life happened. Bob lived in Government Yard, a cluster of barrack-style homes, where families stacked like books on shelves. He shared a bed with cousins, washed in cold basins, and ate what little his mother could provide. Rats scurried between floorboards, and fights broke out like weather shifts. But he never seemed to flinch. Even as a boy, he had the eyes of a lion, intense, searching, quietly watchful. Sadella worked as a domestic helper, sometimes walking miles just to bring home bread and tinned mackerel. She taught Bob resilience, discipline, and the sacred value of faith. She sang to him in the evenings, spirituals and folk songs passed down from generations of the enslaved. Her voice became the first melody in his memory. Sadella believed that life, no matter how cruel, could be endured, and Bob listened. It was in Trenchtown that Bob first met the sound of the streets, not just the distant crackle of radios or the thud of homemade drums, but the rhythm of survival. Music was oxygen there. It bled from open doorways, echoed down alleyways, and exploded in local dances called sound system clashes. DJs with names like Coxondod and Duke Reed dragged massive speakers into courtyards, spinning vinyls that made the whole neighborhood sway. Little boys like Bob would sneak into these sessions, wide-eyed, their bones vibrating with bass. Around this time, Bob earned a nickname, Tuff Gong. No one really remembers who said it first, but it stuck. It meant Little Tough One. He was small, wiry, and quiet, but he held his ground. He didn't fight often, but when he did, he fought with fire. Tuff Gong was more than a name, it was a prophecy. Bob was beginning to find his voice, not just as a singer, but as a seer, a sponge soaking in the chaos around him and turning it into song. He found companionship in Neville Bunny Livingston and later Peter Tosh, two young musicians who would help him shape the soul of the Wailers. Together, they began experimenting with homemade instruments, singing beneath mango trees, dreaming of bigger things. But at this stage, it was still play, still raw potential. The hunger was real, but the vision hadn't yet crystallized. More than music, it was Rastafari that began to stir in the corners of Bob's mind. He saw Rastas on the street, dreadlocked mystics quoting scripture, burning ganja, speaking of Haile Selassie as the living God. To many in Jamaica, Rastas were madmen, outcasts. But Bob didn't see madness. He saw truth. He saw defiance wrapped in spirituality. Men who bowed to no one, who spoke with thunder even in whispers. Rastafari planted a seed of resistance in him, one that would bloom in time. And yet, in these early days, Bob remained tethered to the mundane. He took odd jobs, welding, shining shoes, sweeping floors. He was a dreamer, yes, but not idle. The boy had work in his bones. Every coin he made went into studio time, cheap instruments, or bus fare to wherever music was being played. He recorded his first song, Judge Not, at just 16 years old, a gospel-tinged message that already hinted at a deeper calling. Judge not before you judge yourself. It wasn't a hit. It didn't change the world. But it was a beginning. And beginnings in stories like these are sacred. Looking back, it's easy to mythologize. To paint the child Bob as a prodigy surrounded by signs and omens. But the truth is grittier and more beautiful. He was not born a legend. He became one by enduring, by listening, by refusing to be swallowed by the desperation that threatened to drown his people. He walked barefoot through the streets of Trenchtown not with entitlement, but with observation. He studied the men who suffered, the women who prayed, the children who danced in dust. He took their sorrows into his spirit and began the slow work of turning them into songs that would one day save souls. By the time Bob Marley turned 17, the world still didn't know his name, but Trenchtown did. And the sun that rose over that zinc-roofed jungle each morning rose on a boy who, without knowing it yet, was preparing to become the most powerful musical prophet the world had ever seen. Before the world heard his voice, the streets heard his silence. And it was in that silence that the revolution began. Chapter 2. The Young Rude Boy and the Sound of Rebellion. The rhythm of Kingston pulsed differently in the early 1960s. Jamaica was on the brink of independence from Britain, and the island buzzed with anticipation, rage, and identity-seeking chaos. The streets were cracked with tension. Political posters flapped like wounded birds on every wall. Boys in button-downs shouted over cricket games about Manly and Bustamante, while grown men debated the soul of a nation over warm beer and borrowed radios. The fire for change was rising, and it wasn't just in Parliament. It was in the music, and it was in the youth, especially the ones from Trenchtown. This was the era of the Rude Boys, a new breed of Jamaican youth who refused to bow, who dressed sharp, walked hard, and moved through the alleys with a mix of pride and defiance. The Rude Boys were born out of poverty and colonial residue. They were products of disenfranchisement, but they were anything but meek. They slicked back their hair, wore trilby hats and narrow ties, and adopted the attitude of street vigilantes, sometimes heroes, sometimes hustlers. To the authorities, they were trouble. But to the youth of Jamaica, they were symbols of survival, of swagger, of rejection of control. Bob Marley was not a rude boy in the violent sense. He wasn't robbing banks or cutting through rival gangs, but his energy, his gaze, and his early music vibrated with that same sense of revolution through self-expression. He was short, sharp-featured, with a quiet stare that saw everything. In Trenchtown, boys earned respect not by muscle alone, but by voice, and Bob was beginning to find his. At 17 years old, Bob became a regular fixture at Joe Higgs' Veranda, a dusty, open-air space that doubled as an unofficial music school for youth who couldn't afford proper lessons. Higgs, a local musician with militant discipline and a deep knowledge of harmony, took the rawness of Bob and his friends and began shaping it into something focused, something intentional. It was there that Bob reunited with Neville Bunny Livingston and met the tall, commanding figure of Peter Tosh. Their voices didn't blend at first. They clashed, pulled in different directions. But there was magic in the friction. Higgs saw it. He told them, "You don't need to sound like America. You already sound like Jamaica." At the time, Jamaican airwaves were still drenched in American rhythm and blues. Songs by Ray Charles, Sam Cooke, and Curtis Mayfield dominated the local jukeboxes. But the island's heartbeat was shifting. Ska had emerged, born from the fusion of jazz, calypso, and mento, and it was fast, brassy, and joyous. It was the sound of a people trying to run faster than their pain. And Bob, Bunny, and Peter knew, instinctively, that ska wasn't just music. It was a vehicle, a way to be heard, to claim space, to be young and angry, and alive in a system designed to forget them. In 1963, they named themselves the Wailers, a name chosen not for glamour, but for truth. They weren't stars yet. They were Wailers, the ones crying out, the ones bearing witness, the ones refusing to be quiet. And they were ready to be recorded. Their break came when they caught the attention of Clement Coxon Dodd, the infamous producer behind Studio One, Jamaica's most legendary recording studio. Studio One was both a sanctuary and a battlefield. It was where dreams came to fight for air. The Wailers entered its doors with little more than talent and audacity, but Coxon saw in them what he saw in all revolutionaries: risk. He signed them, and almost immediately, the studio's hot, crowded space became their second home. Their early recordings were filled with aching harmonies and political undercurrents, even when masked in love songs. Simmer Down, one of their first hits, was a warning to the same rude boys whose fire they mirrored. Simmer down, soon you're gonna get dropped. The irony wasn't lost on anyone. Bob, the boy of rebellion, was now asking his brothers to calm their rage. But he wasn't selling out. He was shaping something more surgical. His music didn't call for surrender. It called for elevation, for redirection. Violence was not the revolution. Consciousness was. With Simmer Down climbing Jamaican charts, the Wailers began to walk differently through Trenchtown. They weren't just local boys anymore. They were voices. But fame in Jamaica was a thin veil over poverty. They still lived among peeling walls and shared meals. Bob slept on concrete floors, sometimes eating only bread and tea. But he was driven. He spent long nights scribbling lyrics in notebooks, listening to records by the Impressions and the Drifters, studying how to make meaning fit into melody. But inside Bob, something deeper was stirring, something the fame couldn't touch. A growing hunger for truth, for identity beyond catchy hooks. The Wailers were evolving, and Bob, especially, was beginning to look inward, to his African roots, his spirituality, his confusion over color and class. His voice, once filled with teenage heartbreak and hopeful harmonies, now started to carry a weight. He was no longer just a singer, he was becoming a messenger. Still, the industry was ruthless. The Wailers struggled with contracts that robbed them blind. They were paid pennies while their songs played across Jamaica. Coxon, for all his influence, was also a gatekeeper. Bob grew wary of being controlled, of being told what to sing, how to dress, who to be. It became clear, freedom wouldn't be given. It would have to be taken. This period was also when Bob began to see music not just as entertainment, but as a weapon, a form of storytelling that could break chains, wake minds, shift nations. While other singers crooned about love lost, Bob started writing about truth buried. He didn't want to sing pretty lies. He wanted to sing ugly truth in beautiful ways. Around Kingston, political violence was brewing. Gangs aligned with opposing parties clashed in bloody street battles. The poor were caught in the middle. Bob observed it all with quiet rage. He was never overtly political in conversation, but in his lyrics, the fury bled through. Songs like Rude Boy and Put It On became coded messages, cries for redemption disguised as radio-friendly tunes. The Rude Boy spirit that once defined a generation of rebellion now found its new anthem in Bob Marley. But unlike many who wore the label like armor, Bob wore it like skin, natural, unforced, lived in. He was never trying to be anyone but himself. And in that authenticity, he found power. His early work with the Wailers, though raw and occasionally overlooked today, laid the groundwork for everything that followed. It was the foundation of the Fire. By the mid-60s, the Wailers began to splinter under the weight of poverty, industry politics, and internal pressure. Bunny and Peter were passionate and proud, but Bob was relentless. He refused to stop. He refused to settle. Even as friends fell away, contracts failed, and success remained elusive, Bob kept moving forward like a man possessed, not by ego, but by purpose. Looking back, these years were the forge, the crucible in which the legend was burned into being. He was not yet the global icon, not yet the Rostamon prophet, not yet the man who would move presidents and peasant alike. But the Fire was growing. The rude boy had evolved, not into a gangster, but into a warrior poet. And his weapon was music. Trenchtown gave him the wounds. The rude boy gave him the stance. But it was Bob Marley's own soul, tempered by struggle and truth, that gave him the voice. A voice that was only beginning to rise. Chapter 3. The Wailers Take Root. Roots are not born in sunlight. They are born in shadow, in the silent push beneath the surface, in the struggle of something small refusing to stay small. The Wailers were not a band built in studios or under spotlights. They were born of sweat, of hunger, of bond. They were born in the beating heart of Trenchtown, where barefoot prophets dreamed to the rhythm of a people's pain. By the time the Wailers became more than a name scribbled in a teenager's notebook, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer had already been shaped by Fire. These were not suburban kids with guitars. They were sons of a fractured country, children of cane fields, garrisons, and gunshots. But they had something rarer than talent. They had belief. Not just belief in music, but in each other. And that bond, though tested by time, would become the soil from which the revolution would bloom. Their rehearsals weren't glamorous. Most took place in backyards, verandas, or government yards, with dogs barking in the distance, roosters crowing, and babies crying next door. They had no real instruments at first. Bunny played makeshift percussion. Peter fashioned a guitar from discarded wires and wood. Bob wrote lyrics with a pencil so short it left calluses on his thumb. When they finally began recording demos, they often sang three voices into a single microphone, huddled so close their foreheads touched. They were students of the world. Not in the academic sense, none of them had access to formal music education, but students of sound, survival, and spirit. They studied American soul groups like the Impressions, but infused those tight harmonies with Jamaican patois, rural wisdom, and street spirituality. Their voices didn't just harmonize, they conversed. Peter brought the fire. Militant, bold, unfiltered. Bunny brought the roots. Soft, haunting, deeply spiritual. And Bob? Bob was the bridge. He was the translator of feeling. The glue that held their rough edges together and made them soar. Together, they called themselves the Wailers. Not the Shiners, not the Dancers, but the Wailers. Because they cried out for their people. They howled against injustice. They carried the laments of a thousand broken homes in their lungs and turned them into anthems. And yet, despite this raw power, their journey to recognition was paved with humiliation, betrayal, and near-constant starvation. In 1964, their first breakthrough came with the explosive hit Simmer Down, recorded at Studio One under producer Clement Coxone Dodd. The song surged up the Jamaican charts, a hard-hitting rebuke to the rising violence of rude boy culture. But the success was lopsided. For every hit that played across the island, the Wailers saw pennies, sometimes not even that. Contracts were vague, accounting was murky, and the industry was still in its exploitative infancy. Coxone was a shrewd businessman. He gave them exposure, but little else. Studio One became both a blessing and a cage. The Wailers, still teenagers in many ways, didn't know how to negotiate, didn't understand publishing rights, and didn't have lawyers. What they had was talent and desperation. Bob often had to borrow shoes for public appearances. They sometimes walked miles to recording sessions. Hunger gnawed at their ribs. There were nights Bob lay on a concrete floor with no dinner, only a song humming in his chest, and the weight of his mother's sacrifice in his thoughts. The group recorded dozens of tracks at Studio One, put on It Hurts to Be Alone, Rude Boy, Lonesome Feeling. Some were soft love songs. Others were sharp with social commentary. But all of them were underlined by the pain of their existence, a yearning for something more. Still, frustration grew. The Wailers knew they were more than background music. They were telling the story of a country in transition, a country in pain. And the studio walls couldn't contain them forever. By 1966, cracks had begun to form. Bob, deeply spiritual and seeking clarity, temporarily left Jamaica for Delaware in the United States, where his mother said Ella had migrated. It was a difficult shift. Bob took menial jobs, including working at DuPont as a lab assistant and sweeping floors at a hotel. But the experience was sobering. America was not the land of dreams. It was the land of fluorescent lights, cold stares, and cultural alienation. Bob missed Jamaica, the heat, the music, the pulse. And most of all, he missed the fire of the Wailers. When he returned in 1967, something had changed. Bob was more focused, more serious. He had been exposed to the consumerism of the West, and it had only intensified his belief in roots, community, and consciousness. Around this time, he deepened his commitment to Rastafari, growing his dreadlocks and aligning his lifestyle with the faith's tenets, Ital living, spiritual meditation, and a rejection of Babylon, the system of oppression and falsehoods. Peter and Bunny also found themselves shifting. The band began to evolve in identity and purpose. They weren't just singing anymore. They were preaching, teaching, rebuking. The music slowed, became heavier. The beats turned to rocksteady, then bled into what would become reggae, a slower, deeper, more meditative form of music that felt less like dancing and more like marching. The Wailers were leading that march. By now, Bob had also begun writing more complex, layered songs. Tracks like Bend Down Low and Nice Time showed not just poetic growth, but political awareness. He no longer wrote for love alone. He wrote for liberation, for the sufferers, for the downtrodden who had no voice. Despite their growing talent and underground following, commercial support remained elusive. They went independent, forming Wailin' Solem, their own label. It was a bold, near-suicidal move. Money was scarce, and they struggled to distribute records. But it was a statement: we own our sound. We will not be silenced. The label didn't last long. Financial ruin came quickly, but the message echoed for decades. It marked the moment the Wailers took root, not just in Jamaican music, but in resistance culture. During this time, Bob married Rita Anderson, a young singer from Kingston who would become both his partner in music and a cornerstone of his legacy. Their relationship was complicated, tender, and tumultuous, but Rita's voice and energy helped round out the Wailers' sound. She later became part of the I3s, the trio of backing vocalists that would define the Marley sound during the global years. By the end of the 1960s, reggae had begun to spread its wings. It was no longer a local rhythm, it was a global pulse. But the Wailers, despite being at the center of it, were still scraping by. Bunny was growing frustrated. Peter was openly critical of producers and the system. Bob, ever focused, began emerging as the de facto leader, not by ego, but by vision. Their brotherhood, while still rooted in love and shared struggle, began to feel the pressure of ambition and uneven recognition. Peter wanted more say. Bunny wanted space to explore spirituality. And Bob wanted the world. What kept them bound during this fragile era was the music, that eternal glue. When they sang, everything else fell away. The egos, the hunger, the tension. None of it could survive the truth of a harmony sung from the gut. They were not perfect men, but together, they were divine instruments. And so the Wailers took root. Not in luxury, not in comfort, but in resistance, brotherhood, and uncompromising truth. They were not just a band anymore. They were the voice of a people, rising from dust and zinc and gun smoke. Their sound was no longer asking to be heard. It was demanding it. And soon, the world would have no choice but to listen. Chapter 4, Rastafari Rising. It didn't happen all at once. It wasn't a thunderclap or a vision in the night. Bob Marley's spiritual awakening came like a slow-burning fire, quiet at first, then roaring. It came through the murmur of old men quoting scripture in patios, through the smell of ganja drifting down alleyways, through dreadlocked mystics standing barefoot on dusty corners speaking the names of kings long forgotten. It came in waves, in conversations, in silences, in contradictions. And when it arrived, it didn't just change his music. It changed his life, his purpose, his identity. To understand Bob Marley, you cannot separate the man from the mission. And you cannot understand the mission without understanding Rastafari. The Rastafari movement had taken root in Jamaica in the 1930s, emerging from the fertile soil of post-slavery trauma, biblical prophecy, and Pan-African dreams. It was not a religion in the traditional sense. It was a liberation theology, a way of life, a rejection of Babylon. Babylon, in Rastafari thought, was not a place, but a system. The empire of lies, the legacy of colonialism, oppression, white supremacy, and spiritual corruption. Babylon was every police raid, every land theft, every starving child, while politicians smiled in suits. And against Babylon stood Zion, a spiritual homeland. For Rastas, Zion was Ethiopia. And its living embodiment was Emperor Haile Selassie I, crowned in 1930 and believed by many to be the second coming of Christ, the Lion of Judah, foretold in Revelation. Bob had heard about Rastas as a child. They were strange figures back then, ostracized, misunderstood. Men with long, matted locks, barefoot and unbending, often mocked, feared, or imprisoned for their defiance. Jamaica, still entrenched in British morality, viewed Rastafari as rebellion dressed in madness. The police shaved their heads. The media called them lunatics. Church leaders condemned them as heretics. But Bob listened. He watched. In the late 1960s, Rastafari found Bob, or perhaps more accurately, Bob finally opened himself to it. He began visiting Mortimer Plano, a well-known Rasta elder in Kingston whose presence radiated quiet authority. Plano wasn't loud or theatrical. He was a thinker, a seer, a man who had long advocated for the legitimacy of the faith. Under Plano's guidance, Bob began to study not just the Bible, but the truth between the lines, the Afrocentric reinterpretation of Scripture, the call for repatriation, the ancestral pride stolen by slavery. Bob stopped eating meat. He embraced an Ital diet, natural, plant-based, unprocessed. He started growing his locks, not as a fashion statement, but as a spiritual commitment. He stopped cutting his hair, rejecting vanity, and embracing the Nazarite vow, echoing the ancient Hebrews. He smoked ganja, not recreationally, but sacramentally, using it to enter deeper meditation, to reason with brethren, to connect to the divine without intermediaries. It was not a casual phase. It was a rebirth. Friends and fans noticed the shift immediately. Bob no longer performed with the same carefree charm of his ska days. His eyes were sharper, his lyrics heavier, his soul anchored. He wasn't chasing fame anymore. He was chasing truth, and through that truth, liberation for his people. The Wailers began singing songs that weren't just catchy, but revolutionary. Tracks like Duppy Conqueror, Small Axe, and Soul Rebel began to emerge. Songs soaked in biblical imagery and social defiance. Bob was no longer simply reacting to his world. He was prophesying it. He called out the elite. He spoke of war and peace. He saw himself not just as an artist, but as a vessel. "Me don't come to bow," he once said. "Me come to conquer." As Bob's devotion deepened, so did his connection to Africa, and particularly to Ethiopia. Though he had never set foot on the continent, he spoke of it as home, as Zion, as salvation, as destiny. Ethiopia was more than geography. It was a spiritual ancestry reclaimed. In 1966, when Haile Selassie I visited Jamaica, more than 100,000 Rastas gathered at the airport, chanting, weeping, trembling. Bob wasn't in the crowd that day. He was in the U.S. at the time, but the moment reverberated through his life. Stories from that visit, particularly the one where Selassie is said to have made the rain stop upon exiting the plane, became sacred folklore among Rastas. That day was not a political event. It was a second Pentecost. When Bob returned to Jamaica, he absorbed every detail of Selassie's visit. He read speeches, scriptures, Garveyite teachings. He began referring to Selassie in his lyrics, not abstractly, but as Jah himself. The songs began to speak in spiritual code. Babylon, Zion, Jah Army, Iron Lion. Each word a symbol, each note a prayer. But embracing Rastafari came with costs. Radio stations blacklisted him. Sponsors vanished. The mainstream Jamaican public, still uneasy with dreadlocks and ganja, distanced itself. Even within the music industry, Bob was seen as a risk. But he never flinched. He wore his locks like armor, spoke like a man possessed by prophecy, and sang with the conviction of a preacher in fire. The Wailers followed his lead, but tension brewed. Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer were also devout Rastas, but each had their own interpretations, their own paths. Peter was militant, aggressive, deeply anti-establishment. Bunny was more reclusive, mystical, wary of fame. Bob, meanwhile, walked a different line, fiercely spiritual, yet determined to bring the message to the masses. He wasn't trying to remain underground. He wanted to amplify the cause through the microphone, the stage, the speaker box. That difference in vision, how to balance spiritual purity with global reach, would later pull the trio apart. But at this point in their journey, they were still bound by a shared fire. And Rastafari was the oxygen feeding it. As Marley's lyrics transformed, so too did his audience. In the ghettos of Kingston, people began to gather around his music like a new gospel. In the hills, dreadlocked children repeated his verses like psalms. And in Europe and America, a new kind of curiosity began to form. Who was this young singer with haunting eyes, singing about Africa, Exodus, and judgment? Bob wasn't concerned with appealing to the West. He was concerned with awakening the oppressed. Whether in Trenchtown, Soweto, or Harlem, he wanted people to remember who they were, where they came from, and what they had the power to become. His songs weren't escapist, they were calls to arms. Not with guns, but with consciousness. Redemption is not for the lazy, he said in one interview. It's for those who see through the illusion. In this period, Bob also began to speak more about oneness, the unity of all people through the lens of righteousness. Though deeply rooted in black liberation, his message was never one of hatred. He spoke to the soul, not just a race. To Bob, truth was universal, but the oppressed needed to be heard first. Love was the goal. Justice was the road. By the end of the 1960s and into the early 70s, Bob Marley had become a voice for the voiceless, a prophet for the barefoot masses, a singer not of trends, but of truth. He was not interested in being liked. He was interested in being heard. And what he was saying, now more than ever, was clear. Jah Live. Babylon shall fall. Africa must rise. The time is now.